of cream, red roses too.
This is Ed Cohen, your broadcast host on Global Radio Talk Show, broadcast service of globalbusinessnews.net. Coming to you today from San Diego, California and Washington, D.C. area. Our special guest today is Mr. Hampton Dowling, MBA, PMP, and managing partner of the HCB Group. Hampton Dowling is also chairman of the Committee on International Trade for the Commonwealth of Virginia. And for those who are interested in learning about that kind of thing, the website is exportvirginia.org. Thank you very much for coming on Global Radio Talk Show.
Let's welcome Hampton Dowling.
Well, hi, Ed. I appreciate that.
This is the third in the series with you. And each time we talk about trade and the role of geography, and this time won't be any different. It's just that the world has changed. And so
everything's changing, Ed.
Yeah. So I want to
ask
you.
We all get older and everything changes.
Definitely. With all the trade agreements we keep hearing about, can you give us a quick summary of what's going on? Okay. There's so many things in politics. We don't need to get into that. But with all the trade agreements being torn up or renegotiated, including the new NAFTA deal, not to mention what's underway with China and then the Brexit thing, God, there's so much going on. What's the role of trade agreements when it comes to business?
Oh, Ed, wow, that's a loaded question. There's a lot going on. It's dynamic, not always in the public eye. It's very challenging. I'll try to kind of put it together in a really cogent way. I mean, for starters, center stage here in D.C., it's at the varsity level for negotiation skills. It just doesn't get any more advanced, serious consequentials. I would say, just in my opinion, the trade agreements that are now in their various forms of negotiation collectively, I think they have the greatest effect on world affairs since the end of World War II. Fortunately, and also from my perspective, the general public and much of today's C-suite has become somewhat inoculated from all these opportunities, from really seeing the bigger picture, much less appreciate the importance of forehandedness, I guess you'd say, in the decisions affected by what's going on. I mean, change is happening in volume and, with the velocity of a fire hose. You and I have talked a few times. Just in the past 2 years, think of all that's changed. In January of 2017, 65% of our eligible workforce in the United States, it wasn't working, and no one was working. Gas prices were $3.30 a gallon. We had more banks closing around the world than in history. In fact, there was less trade going on globally than in recorded history. The U.S. was fairly inoculated from that. We were just printing a lot of money. We kept interest rates low. But the markets felt it. And 2017 turned out to be a year of transition. So the trade agreements are all being formulated, put together with a very volatile but improving backdrop. In the past 18 months, 6 million more people in the U.S. have gained full-time positions, not just part-time. All of our leading economic indicators are positive. That's the first time since the 50s. $5 trillion has returned to the U.S. economy, but I think over $8 trillion has returned to the global economy. And for the first time globally, the middle class is actually growing at pace. Here in the U.S., we're seeing more merger and acquisition activity. 54% of our growth in manufacturing is coming from foreign direct investment. We're now the largest exporter of energy worldwide. But a lot of this comes with a lot of uncertainty. We have changes going on with immigration. We've had a significant change in the leadership of House of Representatives. Now, that's just all domestic. When you look at the trade agreements going on, we had a seminal agreement executed between Korea and the U.S. You mentioned renegotiating NAFTA. It's a huge change. And that's all those two agreements. USMCA is now pending in front of three legislatures. U.S.-China is in a very deliberate process. We're also negotiating with the EU, informally with the UK, assuming Brexit moves forward. We have an agreement going on between the U.S. and Japan and the U.S. and India. Those are huge trade agreements. And in parallel with that, we see a U.S. agreement evolving with North Korea. Brexit's moving on. China is feeling sort of a downward pressures on its economy. it's one belt, one road expansion is kind of throttled back a little bit. And then you see things like Venezuela, which is just imploding. And over 4 million people have been displaced in Venezuela. All these activities are in the backdrop of these trade agreements. And let's not forget, the U.S. and China agreement is between the world's two leading economies. Our economy and China put together is 45% of the world's economy. And both nations are the leading military powers, world leaders in technology development. China has the largest population in the world, and we have the third largest population in the world. So the outcomes of just that one agreement between the U.S. and China, the outcome is going to go far in changing what we look at in terms of the world of tomorrow. So when you couple that with USMCA, U.S. and EU, U.S. and India, over the next 12 or 18 months, you're going to see a dramatic change in global behavior. And that has a dramatic impact on business. The past 2 years have just been, they've been moving fast. It's all been on the chassis of a very robust U.S. economy. These trade agreements are going to have a dramatic impact. But for companies, there's a lot of questions that come to mind. Where do companies invest now? What are the new rules? What are the new regulations? What are the implications to business relationships, long-range strategies? How does it affect shareholders and people? There are a lot of things that companies are trying to grapple with in parallel with these very high leverage negotiations that are going to fundamentally transform and change global business.
So I need to jump in and ask some very specific questions about what you just said. And I recognize that an answer may not be possible at this time to these questions.
Sorry, I'll try.
So this isn't all about President Trump. This is big business getting their act together about things. The world has changed. The world economy has changed, as you've noted. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to play by the old rules that were built 10, 20 years ago because the world is different. And that's what's driving it. It's not about President Trump. He's just a mouthpiece, but it's not about him. It's about trade. It's about business.
Yeah, absolutely.
But certainly politics enter into it. But it's really about companies wanting to do business, and government has to get involved. There has to be rules of the road, correct?
There are. And you raised some very good points. It isn't all about our current president. Although 2 years ago, no one was talking about trade. In Washington, trade agreements were just, they weren't on the docket anywhere. The focus of Washington was in different directions. So our president comes in, that he's a businessman. And, he came into office because he had a particular point of view, he had a business point of view. So before he could make changes to business, he had to create leverage. And so politics does come into play, but so do some other things in the background. He had to facilitate a better economy, had to change our military posture, he had to have some wins with foreign policy. He didn't create the issues and the challenges that required change. He framed discussions such that there was a requirement and necessity to address these problems and these challenges, which you mentioned. Business knew that it had to change the way it did business. Technology is changing. People are changing. And these trade agreements that are the engine of the world were based on a very old chassis, post-World War II. And there was no real momentum and inertia to change those agreements. There was too much involved. So we have to give some credit to President Trump for at least putting these agreements on the table and then driving these changes such that business can actually move forward and do what it has to do. And the Fortune 50, Fortune 100, maybe the Fortune 250 companies, they're paying attention to this in different ways, shapes, and forms because they have a lot to do with the engine of the world. But if you're not part of that group, from my perspective, I don't see a lot of the C-suite, a lot of business leadership focusing on what is happening. They're not paying attention to the bigger picture. They're not recognizing what are the trickle-down implications of these agreements and changes to the fabric of business around the world. And that's a problem. And I think that's something that needs to be part of the conversation here in Washington and abroad.
So with that in mind, the role of geography. Geography is one of my favorite topics.
I like it too.
So we've had this conversation before, but if we could just come full circle now with what you just said and say, okay, so I'm just going to wing it with you for a second. Let's just look at South Florida, okay? Miami, right. And it's the closest big port to Panama Canal. And so, and the Panama Canal has been greatly expanded, and Miami's sitting right there. And generally speaking, Latin America economies are growing, but not everywhere, but there's changes going on there for sure. And the culture of South Florida, with the huge influx of, you know, people from Latin America region mixing with American business, and of course the real estate opportunities and the commercial opportunities that go with all that, it's created a giant economic engine in South Florida, all because of the Americas. So I know you're involved in Panama and with a magazine about transport. Give us a few minutes here about what you see vis-a-vis the Americas, Miami as an economic engine, the Panama Canal, things like that.
It's a very good focal point, and I appreciate the opportunity to comment on it. Geography is something that business doesn't pay attention to, I think, to the extent that it should. I've been in three meetings in the past 6 months overseas where I've had foreign CEOs actually stand up and go to a big world map and start to give me their opinion about what the U.S. should be doing, is doing, the impact on their business, trade routes, what China's doing, what Russia's doing, the implications of trade agreements, how much of it is based on the reality of geography, the importance of strategic position of some countries relative to others. You bring up South Florida. Florida is now, I think, the second fastest growing state economy in the U.S. It wasn't previously a big manufacturing state, and now it's growing, I think, at 5 or 6 times the national average. Between Miami, Tampa, the ports are a huge amount of money going into infrastructure. The expansion of the Panama Canal that was completed, and the first transit completed in August of 2016, it has changed the dynamics of ocean transport. All the states and all the nations in the Caribbean, from Colombia all the way up the East Coast of Central America into the Gulf states. Short shipping has increased 4 to 5-fold, meaning smaller ships that feed the larger shipping routes. The U.S. has now become the leading exporter of liquefied natural gas, all coming out of the U.S. Gulf Coast ports. 95% of LNG ships can now transit the canal, which is a huge economic boom for the U.S., but it also enables more nations of the world to easily obtain liquefied natural gas. And that has become important for Latin America. You see a transition to away from solely reliance upon oil. It's now transitioning to natural gas and other sustainable energy sources. You're seeing, because of the U.S. economy, because of the free trade agreements that we have with a number of Latin American countries, the middle class is growing. That means the consumer consumption is growing. Their accessibility to different markets is growing. So I am the editorial director of Transports Magazine. We're the largest, most widely distributed magazine on logistics and industry. And we've seen a real uptick in all the consumer indices. So business is growing. For Florida, which is a gateway to the U.S. from Latin America and from the Caribbean, it is driving huge investments in state infrastructure, their highways, logistics and port infrastructure. So the relationships between Latin America, the Gulf Coast of the U.S., and namely Florida, has become far more active and important than it was just 2 years ago. That's important for the U.S. economy. It's important for bilateral and multilateral relationships. It's also important for us to keep a pulse on counter-narco-terrorism and managing a lot of corruption that still exists in Latin America. Central America is probably home to some of the more pronounced levels of corruption. That's why you see a lot of exodus of folks trying to come up into the United States. There's a lot of money to be made in illegal migration. There's a lot of corruption going on. And hopefully the improvement in the economies of Latin America, but certainly Central America, between Mexico going down to Colombia, as the economies improve, the lives of people will improve. And that'll become a tremendous opportunity for U.S. companies in terms of mobility, being able to develop new business relationships, sourcing materials to improve our productivity up here in the U.S. Just a whole lot of really good things happening between throughout the Americas right now. And it has everything to do with just a thriving U.S. economy and, of course, the expansion of the Panama Canal.
So it seems so logical for U.S. companies to, I don't want to say move away from China, but just expand south rather than east or across the international dayline, just because it's time zone as well as cost of doing business on the surface anyway. I don't know whether the skill sets are there in Central America or Latin America, but I would think that if that region could be developed as manufacturing processing center rather than China, the U.S. companies will benefit from that.
There's always been a great relationship between the U.S. and Latin America. You know, it kind of ebbs and flows depending on the politics of the day. We're just now coming out of an era of electing socialist governments in Latin America, and it's now kind of coming back full circle to electing democratic, free market-based governments. But Latin America does have challenges when it comes to education and skill sets. Between the U.S. and the EU, there's a lot more transference of skills. It's just a lot easier. That's not necessarily the case between North America and South America and Central America. But the advancing economies and the access to better education is there. It's been ongoing now for a couple of years. The increased trade has direct bearing on that. Now, politics, again, does come into play. China is the leading investor in Latin America, measures of degrees. It's an enormous investment that they have. And that's all to bring agricultural products and minerals and other sourced items to support the economic and manufacturing engine in China. China owns a tremendous amount of property around the Panama Canal. They own the largest terminal operations, and they own property at both ends of the canal. Ironically, both used to be U.S. naval bases. So China is very active in Latin America. I think the U.S. has to play a catch-up role. But South America and Central America have always wanted to do business with the United States. You have to remember our history. So much of the history of the United States is predicated on early Spanish exploration, foundations of our missions, entry of the Catholic Church, early trade routes. So, you know, our histories are very much commingled. So I think you will see a much more deliberate level of investment between U.S. companies and their counterparts, colleagues down in Central and Latin America. It's just a natural trajectory, again, especially since the U.S. economy is vastly improved.
So I want to circle back just for a sec on something you just mentioned in passing, which I believe our audience needs to underline. And that is the role of China in Central and South America, particularly buying into Panama in such a big way.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that happening? What does China see that we don't see?
Well, it kind of goes back to geography. The U.S. is the only continent, you know, North America, Canada, and the United States. It's the only continent where the majority of natural resources are found in abundant supply, from fresh water to minerals. We have multiple seasons. We can grow any agricultural product. You know, we're balanced by three bodies of water, the Atlantic, Pacific, and the Gulf of Mexico, natural ports. In terms of manufacturing, export, import, and economic development, the U.S. has always been blessed with having tremendous advantages. That's not the same as China. Despite the enormous size of China, it has to support 1.6 billion people. It has to import almost everything. It does not have an abundant supply of natural resources. And for China to expand itself, consistent with its foreign policy objectives, and to sustain the economic engine that it has grown over the past 25 years, it has to develop relationships abroad in order to ensure that there's a reliable, consistent supply line. And South America certainly provides a lot of that. They have direct access to the West Coast of the Americas. The investment in the Panama Canal is simply one for business, which from China's perspective is all about foreign policy. Their ability to be in the Panama Canal, it allows them to observe merchant traffic that's going through, military traffic that's going through. It's a modern, thriving society. It's modern infrastructure. And from that is a hub of its foreign policy and commercial investments throughout mainly South America. So whereas the U.S. has not been as dependent upon South America as other countries, China is dependent on South America and Africa for the source of most minerals that are essential to their industry and agriculture products. And it's very inexpensive in terms of transportation to ship something from the Americas to China. So generally the reason why you see China heavily invested in the Americas, and it's just very consistent with their foreign policy around the world. They're investing heavily in Central Asia, which is what we comfortably call the STAN countries, Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, lots of oil and natural gas reserves. They're putting in railways and roads. And it's all to establish arteries of logistics that feed the heart, which is China and its economic engine. And this is what Japan had to do in the 30s. If you recall, Japan is an island nation and an empire, but it didn't have any natural resources. So it had to expand in Southeast Asia with rubber and oil and the minerals and those things that fed the economic engine of the day. And you're seeing China do very much the same thing, and it has to deal with the same thing China did, which is the United States and our economic prowess, our military footprint. So if you look in history, you'll see a lot of what China's doing today, although it's with different technologies, different business practices. It's all very much a near mirror image, and it includes the same challenges that Japan had before. So the U.S. and China will constantly see each other in the Americas. I certainly have in my business practices, and they're very formal. But their needs are greater than the United States. Ours is more of protection, relationship development, and association of cultures. Again, going back to the history of the United States, for China, it's a matter of survival.
Thank you very much for that. Those are fundamentals. So I want to step aside for a minute here and ask you about Northern Virginia, or Virginia as a whole. I mean, it's really been so important in American history since the very beginning. And even now, there's so much change going on, particularly in Northern Virginia. In your role as chairman of the Committee on International Trade for the Commonwealth of Virginia, do a couple of minutes here with me about the foreseeable impact of Amazon in going south and the Dulles area and west of D.C. Those two sectors are booming, aren't they?
Well, obviously, I'm very partial to Virginia, although I'm from Southern California. You know, I'm from your neck of the woods. I went to UCLA. I was a beach lifeguard. I did all those things. And yep. You know, I even served down in San Diego with the Navy. But Virginia, there's a lot of history here, but it also has a lot to do with geography. We keep going back to geography. I mean, the ports of Hampton Roads, you know, Norfolk and the Chesapeake Bay, they feed the economic heartland of the United States. In fact, it's less expensive and more efficient and faster to ship any products from China through the Panama Canal and up to the ports of Hampton Roads to get on a railway car and go to Ohio than it is to go to the ports of LA and Long Beach and get on a train and go to Ohio. You wouldn't think so, but it's just the efficiencies of ports, throughput issues and the like. And so Virginia is growing like most other states in the union. It has a lot to do with just the economics of the country. But Virginia, we're trying to do better in terms of trade-related economic growth. A lot of states are. States are always in competition with each other. I mean, I can't speak for the governor and the legislature, but I can tell you that Virginia is being every bit as aggressive as Texas and California and Georgia and Florida for foreign direct investment, attracting business, trying to improve manufacturing output to improve our export potential. But Northern Virginia, since you mentioned it, is rather unique. It's the fastest growing area in the country in terms of population, job growth, and median income. Every Fortune 250 company has a presence in Northern Virginia. We're the technology corridor that's side of Silicon Valley. Every foreign country is represented in Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C. So, in fact, in Loudoun County in Northern Virginia, every day, about 78% of all the world's internet traffic actually physically goes through Loudoun County. Just because we have more data centers here than anywhere else in the world, it's kind of amazing the growth who's coming here. But we're attracting a lot of companies just the same as other states. So we just attracted Amazon here for their HQ2 just outside of Washington, D.C. The infrastructure is here. The academic talent is here to support the technology growth that they anticipate going forward from the headquarters perspective. The transportation networks are here to satisfy their fulfillment centers, their distribution centers. So it's all part of their grand plan. We see a lot of that with other large corporations, both foreign that invest in the U.S. and U.S. companies that want to expand. I think this is a great time for states that are playing a bigger role in supporting the companies that are in their states to become more competitive abroad with international trade, but also part of that, just the competition to attract college graduates, companies to become headquartered. And it also puts greater pressure on those states that are high tax states, as opposed to those states that don't have high taxes, where union enrollment may not necessarily be as a requirement as it may be in other states. So again, the U.S. economy is driving a lot of changes. States that have the benefit of geography, ports, railway systems, that's very important. And all these factors are being observed by foreign governments and foreign corporations that want to invest here. So if you're just getting around D.C., trade agreements, that's all anybody's talking about. And foreign direct investment, especially those companies that invest here for the purposes of manufacturing so they can turn around and export from the United States. That's really where states and U.S. corporations are focusing their attention right now.
So all of this has to do with talent, of the talent mobility. It's all tied together.
Oh, yeah. If you're asking me about the implication of these trade agreements on talent,
yeah,
I would say it's huge. I think it's very profound, not only for the management of talent, but also for mobility, I guess, to get about relocation services, but also legal services that support both of those industries. We're going to, because of these agreements and everything that you and I have just been talking about, you're going to see changes in the forecasts of consumer demand, the terms and expectations of business agreements, how business is conducted, business strategies, value propositions. If you just look at what's happened with USMCA and the US-Korea agreements, there's huge changes to establish foreign operations concerning manufacturing, distribution, channel partners, joint partnership, foreign national employment, joint ownership, access to infrastructure, the full scope of tax exposure. Business strategies just with USMCA and Korea are all in a near complete rewrite, just in terms of foreign operations and sourcing. Now, domestically, there are huge implications. In the U.S., B-1 and B-2 visas for short-term business and B-2 visas for medical purposes, they're going to see immediate changes that are very profound. The F-1 visas for students, they're already seeing impacts. The H-1 and H-2 visas for professionals to live and work across the U.S., likely to see holistic changes simply because of the terms and conditions of these trade agreements. Now, our administration, as we all know, is very focused on immigration vulnerabilities. But this is also, the issue is also going to be compounded by the nature of these trade agreements. Foreign direct investment is going to continue to go through a lot of changes, certainly on the technology side. And this has a trickle-down effect on business attraction, regional employment, and ultimately foreign access to U.S. consumers and users. Again, this gets to mobility, relocation, and talent requirements. You're going to see implications to the exportable professional services across all market verticals, plus agriculture, agro-related products and services. The terms, you're going to see changes to official definitions and interpretations of products and services and points of origin and trademarks, which in turn affects every aspect of global commerce in all market verticals. Changes are always consequential, and they have long tails of very busy compliance. The policy changes are going to be seen to intellectual property protection. And that, of course, has extensive reach into data and information management and standards and copyright laws and legal jurisdiction, corporate ownership of materials, and a variety of civil matters affecting corporations. And then, of course, you have changes to the upstream and downstream logistics and the full scope of trade activities that affect 3PL and 4PL providers and shipping lines. The list is really endless. From large corporations to mid-sized companies to home basement exporters, from Amazon to Walmart to local retailers to manufacturing companies, all these implications are going to be felt. And generally speaking, you're going to see holistic changes to talent and the complexity of the talent requirements. You're going to see changes to technology and automation, which then drives diversity to a number of challenges that affect the bottom line. Markets and consumer demography are going to change, and the scale of international trade and business market channels are going to change. In my mind, the impact to talent requirements is going to be profound. Those companies that don't pay attention to how the bigger picture is going to drive change, to relocation companies that don't really understand the details associated with trade agreements and the upside and downside to their business strategy, if legal counsel doesn't really pay attention to some of these initial signals that are in clear visibility in Washington that impact immigration rules and visas. Collectively, if people aren't paying attention to this, they're going to be caught up short. And their business strategies are, they're going to find themselves rolling in on a Sunday night, trying to figure out what they missed, change their business strategy in order to maintain market share. And meanwhile, those companies that have been paying attention, the right leverage and positioning themselves now, they're going to take over market share, and they're the ones that are going to get the business.
Fascinating stuff, Hampton Dowling. I thank you very much. Let's jump over to New York and the recent Amazon decision to walk away.
That's tragic.
That's just a local mess. I read your article, your post, and you raised some really interesting points about the losses that companies that made deals with other companies in the region because of the pending influx or developments, and all that's sunk now. It's just lost, right?
Yeah, I think what you saw in New York was just tragic. I feel sorry for that. The Amazon solicitation was the largest commercial solicitation in U.S. history, and it came on the scene with very little fanfare as opposed to other large corporations like Apple and Google and others. Amazon was very muted. They played their hand very close to their chest, did it in a very disciplined way, and negotiations were very quiet. The turnaround time for proposals from states or jurisdictions that wanted, that expressed an interest in that solicitation, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks. It was very, very tight turnaround, which was a way of Amazon looking at proposed sites and those jurisdictions and getting an understanding of whether those states or jurisdictions had their act together, whether they really, really had something to offer, or did they need a longer period of time in order to invent something to offer. Well, in the end, I mean, you had a lot of states that were in competition. I think it went from 200 to 20 to 5 or 6, and then eventually came down to New York and Northern Virginia winning. It was an all of government, all of industry effort by those two jurisdictions. It certainly was by the Commonwealth of Virginia. We had the Economic Development Authorities of Northern Virginia getting together to put together a very robust proposition to Amazon. And New York was doing the same thing. Tremendous investment by people, by both Amazon and those two jurisdictions, just the tremendous hours, a lot of negotiation, a lot of activity in the background. In order to propose something, a lot of things happen in the background. A lot of buyer agreements have to take place. A lot of negotiated understanding has to be completed. Parties that wouldn't normally talk to each other found a need to get together to agree on something that, because of Amazon, might not otherwise be a subject that they had to even talk about. So in the end, the biggest commercial solicitation in history was awarded to New York and Northern Virginia. And the assumption by Amazon is that all parties agree to what was proposed. And it was indeed very unfortunate that New York found itself post-negotiation, post-agreement, that their legislative representatives to the House of Representatives, a couple of them, really opposed this in a very dramatic way. I mean, the Amazon solicitation was all about free market economy. It represents Amazon really represents a very forward-looking business model. It represents the future. If you don't think, people need to look at Amazon as a business model for going forward. I mean, Amazon's fulfillment centers, their ground and delivery and drone service is now going to be in competition with FedEx and UPS. They have an enormous online enterprise system. They have a world-class customer service platform. There's now Amazon Travel, Amazon Global Management. And all this is going to be administered out of New York and Northern Virginia. It's the future of industry. It's a very technologically advanced, forward-looking business model. And New York had an opportunity to benefit from that. And you have legislatures that had it's a socialist, it's a progressive, anti-free market, anti-capitalist view of representation. And Amazon saw business risk. If I was a businessman and I looked at the post-negotiated environment of where I was going to be conducting the future of my business, and I saw what was happening, I would definitely cancel that agreement. And you mentioned the post-agreements in New York. You can only imagine the real estate deals that were rapidly closed as a result of that Amazon award. Just the secondary and tertiary economies that were changing in some reflects, had changed in order to prepare for Amazon to move to New York. And all those deals are now sunk cost investments. It's cost people their jobs, their futures, and the opportunity costs are huge. I think there's lessons learned here that it's important for negotiations in business to ensure that everybody that's behind you, and I'm speaking about the lead negotiator, that everybody behind the lead negotiator is on the same page, that they're all in agreement of what's being proposed, and most certainly that there are no changes post-negotiation, which would, like it's in this case, cause one party to the agreement, in this case Amazon, to pull out. And within 24 hours of Amazon pulling out, you saw the other states and jurisdictions that placed second, third, and fourth return, go right back to approaching Amazon, mainly Kentucky and Tennessee and Georgia and the like. And those states and jurisdictions will thrive. They'll benefit for decades. In New York, the opportunity costs are in the tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of employees, and the opportunity to have a very forward-looking, a leading flagship business recognized worldwide being headquartered in their jurisdiction. It's just tragic, absolutely tragic.
So I need to give you a little bit of perspective. I was in New York just right before Amazon made the decision to pull out, and going from Manhattan out to the airports, you go right nearby Long Island mm-hmm. City, and mm-hmm. the streets, and I won't call them neighborhoods, but the streets that are between the Midtown Tunnel and out to Astoria, where LaGuardia is, right. closer in to Manhattan, dilapidated and old, and they've been there since World yep. War One. And right. that area, right in those square 2 miles or so, was going to go through an absolute transformation because of companies yeah. wanting to cluster in, be close to Long Island City, not in Manhattan, but just outside. And
sure, absolutely.
And, mm-hmm. and all of that now is in jeopardy.
Oh, it's gone. I mean, Amazon is not returning. They're yeah. already in active negotiation with other jurisdictions.
Yeah, but others that are watching all this, they're not going in unless until things change. And so that area is just going to go down even more.
Well, you know, Ed, I mean, there's a lesson there. You know, everything presents a lesson. And, you know, for your audience, folks that are dealing with relocation and mobility and talent recruitment, I mean, for months from the New York's perspective, they're looking at what talent is going to be required to support Amazon. You know, what's going to be required of academia, what's going to be required of local investment, regional investment, state investment in infrastructure, and roads and everything. And all this was being planned and laid out, and that's all very much part of the proposal that was put in front of Amazon and accepted by Amazon, very much the same as what Virginia did for Amazon. And to see that really go to waste is tragic. And it tells business, when you're part of these negotiations, either in an ancillary way or very much on the margins, like talent companies that are trying to give input and recommendations to, in this case, New York, you have to recognize that things may not work out, but to remember what it is that you're doing, to use that information for different purposes, to always have a plan B and a plan C. And I think that opportunity will present itself as across the United States, where we look at these trade agreements and try to predict and anticipate what's the result of these agreements. You're going to get it. You may be close to getting everything right, but you're not going to get everything right. But you have to be forward-leaning. You have to participate. You have to learn from your mistakes and be ready to shift on a dime and move in a different direction. But recognizing, as people do with Amazon, that things are changing, that it's worth the investment, and things are going to change as a result of these trade agreements. Amazon is not immune to these trade agreements. They knew that New York stood to benefit from these agreements, just as Virginia stood to benefit from these agreements. And New York just made a catastrophic error. It will be a lifetime before the state actually recovers from that.
Talking with and learning from Hampton Dowling, MBA, PMP, managing partner with HCB Group. Thank you so much, Hampton Dowling, for being our special guest today on Global Radio Talk Show, and happy birthday to you.
Thanks a lot, Ed. I appreciate it.
Okay, this is Ed Cohen signing off.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful